Dear colleagues and friends, it's a great pleasure for me to be here today and to talk to you about from individual decisions to collective behavior. So some of you might wonder, well, what do these psychologists actually have to contribute to the study of collective behavior? Because typically, actually what we do is we study one individual sitting in front of a computer doing some weird experiment, and that's what we typically do. And so what I'd like to do today is I'd like to illustrate the work that we are doing so that you understand the kind of paradigms that we are using, and I'd like to think about what could this mean for collective behavior. And of course, we also have a few results. Maybe as some background information, as a theoretical perspective that we have on human decision making in individuals, and I think that also applies to collectives, is that we see rationality as an interaction between mind and environment. So you cannot understand rational or irrational behavior if you don't consider the match or mismatch between the mind and its capabilities and the structure of the environment. I think that's extremely crucial, and I think that's also a view that fits very well to the biological perspective. And in the science of decision making, we basically typically take three perspectives, not all at the same time, but typically one of them or several of them. We have a descriptive perspective. That's basically just asking, how do people actually make decisions? So this understanding the underlying decision processes, the underlying cognitive mechanisms. We also have a normative perspective. That's asking the question, how should people make decisions in a particular environment, and also given their mind, for instance, their level of expertise. Yeah, that might matter for that. And we have an applied perspective. That is basically the question, how can we use these basic research findings that we have to help people make better decisions in the real world? And most applications that we have are in health. Some are also in environmental decision making. So the approach I'd like to take today is that I try to take hopefully more or less interesting phenomena or paradigms from the level of the individual, and then ask the question, well, how does this phenomenon behave on the collective level? Or to be more honest, it's actually mostly the group level. So for us, collectives have between 3 and 10 people typically in our studies. Yeah, so it's small group research mostly. And the question is, do individual biases cancel each other out, or do they actually get amplified in groups, and when is which the case? And the phenomena I brought for you, and they are relatively loosely connected to one another, I have to admit, just to really give you an idea how our research looks like, these phenomena. So first we can think about aggregation. There it's basically us as researchers who pool individual judgments to make predictions. Yeah, the wisdom of crowd stuff, you will see that in a minute. Second, we have consensus decision making. So imagine a group of individuals that needs to reach a decision together. Yeah. How do they do this? How well do they do this? We have social influence. That's basically when individuals influence each other in terms of either knowledge and or beliefs. Yeah. So there it's more about the influence of one person to the next. And then we have strategic games, actually, that Urs knows much more about than I do. This is where the individual outcomes, so that one individual has, depend on the choices that others make. And for each of those, we actually have some data on the individual level and on the group level, and are interested in that. Well, for strategic games, it's only on the group level, obviously. So let's start with aggregation. So I think in the collective behavior seminar, I probably do not need to explain this example. Now, this is Francis Galton, who in the early 20th century visited a country fair. And on this country fair, there was a competition. People needed to estimate the weight of an ox. Yeah? And what Galton did is he was collecting the about 700 or 800 individual estimates and pooled those. And what he found was that actually the individual estimates, most of them were actually not very accurate. Most of them were kind of over or underestimating the true weight of the ox by quite some amount. But when he pooled all of them, actually in the end, the median and mean were extremely close, so only with a difference of 1 kilogram to the weight of the real ox. So this, I think, was the first example of the wisdom of crowds. That's kind of the seminal textbook example that we have. And of course, this pooling knowledge can be used in other fields, for instance, in medical diagnosis. So here, colleagues from us, from Berlin, and this includes some of the colleagues we have in our cluster, so some of our collaboration partners, they pooled individual judgments by radiologists from x-rays, where they had to decide whether a woman had breast cancer or not. Yeah? And they kind of, so it was not a discussion among these radiologists, but it was individual judgments that were then pooled by the researchers. Yeah? And you have here the individual accuracy in terms of sensitivity, so that's basically detecting when a woman has breast cancer, and 1 minus specificity, that's the false positive rate, that's basically erroneously saying that a woman has breast cancer, although she doesn't. Yeah? So you want to have high values on sensitivity, and you want to have low values on the false positive rate. Yeah? And you can see the individuals have a 75% sensitivity and a 33% false positive rate or so. And so now if we pool the judgments and always compare it to the best individual in these groups, then what we see is that, of course, when we pull these judgments, when we bring more people or pull the judgments of more people, then the accuracy goes up, both in terms of an increased sensitivity, but also in terms of a decreased false positive rate. And you can see that the majority actually in all these groups outperforms the best member of these groups. Yeah. So this is something that can actually be useful in actual clinical practice, not only theoretically. So now, what can we contribute to this field of aggregation as scientists of the individual decision maker? What do we know from individual decision making that could be interesting for this? And what we study a lot in individuals is actually the power of very simple decision rules, yeah? Very simple heuristics, as we call them. And what is surprising about these simple heuristics is that they perform surprisingly well in many environments, especially under high uncertainty, and they sometimes even outperform more complex decision rules. Yeah? I think that is something that is interesting on the individual level. And what is part of that is that people who ignore information and think less or more intuitively can sometimes also outperform those who ignore less information, think more, think less intuitively, and so forth. And this is something that we particularly find for experts. So can we now use these insights that we have from the individual level? Can we use them on the group level, actually? And what's also important before I go to the group level is that this power of simplicity has actually been recognized in other fields, including biology. John McNamara is probably someone, and Houston, these are probably people whom many of you know, who stated in a paper that although behavioral ecologists have built complex models of optimal behavior in simple environments, we argue that they need to focus on simple mechanisms that perform well in complex environments. Yeah? So just turn it around. So this has actually been recognized in other fields. Now, can we harvest that for aggregating decisions? Look at tasks like this. So this is something that we do in our lab quite frequently. Yeah? Who will be more successful in the 2020 Democratic Party presidential primaries? Bernie Sanders or John Hickenlooper? Yeah? Who of you has heard the name Bernie Sanders? Yeah? You don't need to have any more knowledge. Who of you has heard the name John Hickenlooper? Well, at least a few individuals. I'm impressed, yeah, because I've never heard of this guy before until I looked him up. So a very simple prediction now could be that the person who is recognized by more individual will actually get more votes. Yeah? And this is something that we have studied in a plethora of German elections mostly, and it actually works pretty well. Why does it work well? Well, you have some future election result, and the higher this election result, actually, you find that the more is reported about these people already beforehand in the newspaper, and the more the reports there are in the newspaper about particular candidates or political parties, the more likely they are to be recognized. And then you can use recognition as a shortcut to actually predict the election result directly. And it's a very simple decision rule that works surprisingly well. And what is interesting about it, it also relies on a certain degree of ignorance. If all of you had recognized both Bernie Sanders and John Hickenlooper, we couldn't have made this decision based on recognition alone. So it requires that we are semi-ignorant. And actually, this works remarkably well. If we aggregate these recognition judgments, or also estimates, when people are asked, what do you think? How many people will recognize this party or this person? We can predict election results. So here's the actual votes on a log scale. And here you see in the mean estimated recognition, and actually from a really crappy sample. Yeah? These are only 34 people, students in our lab, very non-representative. So you couldn't have made an opinion poll. Yeah? Then you would have had a prediction that the Greens would get 40 or 50% or so. Yeah? So it's a largely biased sample. And you can see, even with just asking 34 people, we get remarkably good predictions of the election outcomes. Yeah? So we can harvest the power of these simple decision rules. Can we probably also harvest the power of fast decisions that we see in experts? So if you look at expert behavior, for instance, a seminal study by Sian Bailok and her colleagues was in playing golf. And she compared experts to novices. And they were either instructed to really focus on accuracy, concentrate on accuracy, or they were instructed, yeah, just go ahead and do it quickly. Yeah? And what you can see is that the instructions interact with the level of expertise. Yeah? Novices were generally worse than experts. This is something that we should expect. But for novices, they actually benefited when they concentrated on accuracy, whereas experts were actually better when they didn't think so much about it, but just went about it and did it quickly. Yeah? So we can see that fast, in this case, it's behavior, not a judgment, but that fast behavior can actually outperform like kind of the deliberate mode of going slowly about things. Yeah? So can we harvest that for the wisdom of crowds? So can we aggregate fast judgments and how well do we perform? One domain where we think most of us are actually experts are the judgments of proportion. So we showed our participants stimuli such as this one. What is the percent black in here? Yeah. You can take a guess, and it's 45%. Yeah, it's easy to see. Yeah. And what we then did, we had different time pressure conditions. They needed to do it in 500 milliseconds, 1,000 milliseconds, 5,000 milliseconds, or had unlimited time, and had to give these judgments. And here on the y-axis, you see the error rate, actually. So more is actually worse. Yeah, you want to have low error. And what we can see is that on the level of the individuals, we find slight differences actually favoring the faster conditions. Yeah, but the differences are very small. Yeah? So now what happens if we aggregate, pool these judgments? Then we get a wisdom of crowd for all of the time conditions. Yeah? So with pooling the judgments, of course, the error goes down across conditions. But actually, the pooling benefits are larger in the time pressure condition than in the conditions with low time pressure. Yeah? So here you see it for the fast condition. It's a huge aggregation benefit. And for the 5-second condition, the benefit is much smaller. And this holds identically for the other conditions. And now we want to go a step further. Can we actually aggregate fast judgments in real judgments, again, in diagnostic decision making? And we look at skin cancer and have shown lesions such as this one to dermatologists, and either, again, under time pressure or with unlimited time. And the results are yet to come. Yeah? So this is only a teaser. We have just done the study, still in the phase of pre-registering the analyses and so forth. So this is still to be analyzed. Yeah? But we can see that maybe there's insights from individual decision making that we can harvest for aggregation. Let's go a step further to consensus decision making. If we have groups of individuals who need to make decisions together. And I want to start with a very basic task. This is basically something that I started in my dissertation, which was longer ago than I would want it to be. And this is called probability learning. Basically, in this basic task, and you see also here other animals, so this is something that's not only studied in humans, but in many animals, the task is to repeatedly choose between options A and B. And one of them will yield a reward and the other not. And the probability of one yielding a reward is typically higher for one option than for the other. Say it's 70% for A and only 30% for B. And there are two prototypical strategies that we can observe. The maximizing strategy, that's the rational one, is always choose the option with the higher probability of reward. Yeah? Always choose A, so in all trials. Yeah? 100% of the trials, you should choose A, then you have an expected accuracy of 70%. What we often see in humans is that they actually match the probabilities. So they choose the options in proportion to the reward probability, and that yields lower expected accuracy in this case, only 58%. And of course, this is surprising because humans are considered to be relatively smart. And here you have a statement about that, which is an old statement by a famous economist, but I think it's still what many psychologists think about this phenomenon nowadays. He said that the remarkable thing about this is that the asymptotic behavior of the individual, even after an indefinitely large amount of learning, is not the optimal behavior. Thus, there is no indication that the individual is maximizing, even in the sense of approaching a maximum. So humans fail to learn this simple task. And then people argue, well, probably humans are just too stupid for this task. And I would argue the other way around, probably the task is too stupid for humans, because there's surprising evidence, actually, that we find more maximizing, so more rational behavior, with lower cognitive capacities. So with people who are distracted, they maximize more. People with lower memory span, they maximize more. Even people with brain damage show the rational behavior, specific kinds of brain damage. And many actually animals that we wouldn't consider smarter as humans, such as pigeons or rats. Yeah, maybe the biologists would disagree here, but I would say they're probably not smarter than humans. So this is surprising. So is there another explanation why humans show this behavior and persistently show it? Well, there is, namely that they search for patterns because they don't believe in the randomness of the sequence. Yeah. And then any pattern that there could be needs to match the marginal probabilities. Yeah. And this basically draws on a very well-documented phenomenon, namely the misperception of randomness. Yeah. Humans perceive patterns in random sequences. And all of you have seen this if you've seen any of my talks. I always use this example. I love it. Steve Jobs, who brought us the iPod. And the iPod has a shuffle function that plays tracks to you at random, but people were complaining about the shuffle function. Yeah? It wasn't random enough. The iPod had favorites. Some artists were just selected more often than others. This is exactly what we would expect by randomness in the short run. Yeah? And our memory is not so large, so we typically can think of maybe the last day, maybe the last week, but not much longer. Yeah? So it's actually perfectly, as perfectly random as it can be. But of course, Apple took these concerns seriously and introduced the smart shuffle that increased the alternations. And Steve Jobs summarized it nicely. We're making it less random to make it feel more random. Yeah? Because with more alternations than you'd expect by randomness, and it feels more random to people. Yeah? So that's a very basic phenomenon. We are kind of pattern seekers. And we wanted to see, is actually the search for patterns and also finding them, is it related to this irrational misperception of randomness. Yeah? So we had one half of some experiment. This is again how experiments look like. Yeah? So they're not very fancy. You have a computer screen, you have a fixation cross, and then you need to make a prediction whether some square would come above the fixation cross or below. And one option is rewarded with a higher likelihood than the other. Yeah? And they are IID, so it's perfectly random. And after this, we put people in a pattern half, actually, that had the same marginal probabilities, but now people could learn for a sequence of 12, like a perfect order of those, and could perfectly predict that. And what we found, actually, across two experiments is that probability matching, so the seemingly irrational behavior in the probabilistic half, is related to finding patterns in the pattern half. Yeah? So you see this curvilinear relationship, and the middle guys, those are those who basically match or slightly overmatch, and these are the maximizers, and these are people who just guess, and here you have basically how good they are on the patterns, and you can see it's the maximizers stuck on finding the patterns. Yeah, the matchers are those who actually find it. Yeah? So could it be, from that we kind of interpret that the misperception of randomness is a flip side of adaptive and cognitively demanding pattern search. And this could actually be adaptive in a largely non-random environment, but of course it could be pathological in the extreme. Yeah? So for instance, we studied pathological gamblers, and they actually do believe they can beat the casino eventually. They have almost figured the pattern out. Yeah? They just need to spend a little more money, and of course they get poorer and poorer. And now the question is, what does it have to do with collective behavior? Well, we ask the question, how do groups compare to individuals in exactly this kind of experiment? So here, groups of three did exactly this experiment, and they needed to coordinate their decision. So they needed to reach a consensus. And we compared their accuracy to the best individual, to the second best, and the third best in nominal groups that were simulated out of the individual decisions. Yeah? And you can see is that groups in the probabilistic half, groups do as well as the best individual, yeah, in nominal groups of three. So they are really good. They can really harvest the benefits. However, what's interesting in the pattern half, actually, we also see that there's some groups who do remarkably well, who have almost perfect accuracy in the pattern half. But we see it's a bimodal distribution. We have other groups who absolutely fail to identify the pattern. And we see the same curvilinear relationship for individuals and for groups. Again, that those who match are actually more likely to then find the pattern. And we find this in both groups and individuals. And by the way, this is joint work with Christine Schulze, again, from our collaboration partner in Berlin from the Max Planck Institute. And what's nice about doing a study like this in a group is that people talk to one another. Yeah? So we can learn something about the thought process by analyzing the group discussions. And what we did is we analyzed the group discussion and looked at it as a function of, were they actually probability maximizers? Were they pattern matchers? So did they find the pattern? Yeah, either of the two? Or did they actually succeed in doing both? Yeah, these are the best groups. And then we find that the statements they make in the group discussion matches their performance. Yeah? So here you see matching statements. So such as there is some specific pattern idea, such that they try to analyze the pattern or make a pattern reference. And you see these are typically more likely in the pattern matchers or those who succeeded in both, but less likely in those groups who only maximized. And the reverse is true for maximizing statements. Yeah? So statements that explicitly refer to the maximizing nature, they are more likely in those maximizing only groups compared to the other two groups. Yeah? So this is, and actually also yields interesting insights about the individual. Yeah? So we get something back from studying groups, also for understanding the individual, which I find nice. We have other paradigms, and this I will walk you through very quickly just to show you. And this is again a case of a medical decision making, diagnostic decision making. And this is basically a specific case of multi-attribute decision making, where people have to look at several cues, have to search for information, maybe have to integrate this information to make decisions. Yeah, it's also kind of a very general case. And basically, breakdowns in the diagnostic process still result in a staggering toll of harm and patient death. So understanding diagnostic decision making is very important, and maybe it gives us some insights that we can use to actually improve diagnostic decision making. So the questions that we ask in these kinds of paradigms, and it's only like a case study, is how do people, in this case clinicians, search for information, and how do they integrate this information? And then the question we can ask for the group level is, can teamwork actually improve diagnoses, and how does teamwork change the diagnostic process? And here we did a kind of high fidelity mouse lab study where people saw a case vignette and a patient video even. And then they could collect diagnostic data about this patient. And this actually looked like real medical data, real x-rays, a real physician letter, EKG, and so forth. Yeah? So they could look at this information, had many, many cues they could look at as they would in a real medical diagnosis. And then they could choose a diagnosis and also needed to indicate the confidence. And actually, we had groups of two people performing the task and individuals. And the two people, again, needed to find a consensus. And these were medical students. Yeah? And the task was validated with experts who were experienced diagnosticians. And what you can see is that dyads actually outperform individuals in this task. The diagnostic process has not changed, so they have not looked at more or less information, but somehow they seem to be able to integrate the information better in dyads. And this may look as a small effect. It increases the number of correct diagnoses from 3 to 4 out of 6, but actually it's a substantial Cohen's d of almost 0.8. So it's actually a relatively large effect size with just bringing two medical students in the third semester together, and it actually helps. Okay, so far we have seen where the group or aggregation actually helps by making better decisions. Now we turn to social influence. And there also, I mean, Mark Zuckerberg also had the dream, is that when you give everyone a voice and give people power, the system usually ends up in a really good place. So he had the idea that by social media, we can actually harvest the wisdom of crowds. And the question is, well, is this really the case? And to study this, we basically set up an experiment about social influence that looked like this. So it was a diffusion chain or telephone game. The first person in our diffusion chain received information, in that case about a chemical named triclosan, which is an antibacterial agent that's very common in many cosmetic products, for instance. And that person received kind of balanced information, pros and cons and so forth. And then was talking about it to a second person. The second person was then talking about it to a third and so forth. And after 10 people or so, we stopped the diffusion chain. And we wanted to see how the information actually evolves in such groups. So we looked at the propagation of information and we analyzed this for each of the chains. And what you could see is, for instance, here you already see an example for an amplification of risk, the side effects about mice and rats on the heart function. It's basically what was in the article is that the pumping function of the heart decreased by about 25%, and at position 10, so when this basically was communicated in the chain, mice died of heart problems. Yeah? So the risk became much more severe in the process of communication. And this also, when we analyzed it quantitatively, is what we found. So what you see here are normalized survival rates of information. You have the blue ones, which are alleviating information, positive information, and the red ones, which are alarming information. And you see that alarming information has a higher likelihood of surviving the communication than alleviating information. Yeah? So the signal becomes worse. So it's especially positive information that dies out. It dies out even more quickly than neutral information, as you can see here. Yeah? So the big picture is we have a feedback loop. We have a signal of incoming message that influences the risk perception. Yeah? And alarming information is considered more strongly here. And then the risk perception also influences the signal of the outgoing messages. So yeah, so depending on your own risk perception, you will also spread information that depends to your belief, that fits to your belief, actually. Yeah? So if you are very worried about triclosan, then you will also spread a more worrying message about triclosan. Yeah? So it's kind of a self-reinforcing system. And what we looked at in simulations is, what is if we have like-minded individuals in a group? And this experiment we had, it was random assignment of groups, but what happens if we have like-minded individuals? Yeah? And then what we can see in these simulations, so maybe let's look at this. This is risk perception after one transmission, 10 and 50 transmissions. And here we have the initial risk perception. Say here they are not worried, and here they are very worried initially. And then you have the injected signal, which cannot be worrying or which can be very alarming. And what you basically see is that the groups in these simulations, with a simple mechanism of fitting the message to their own belief, basically, even if the message says something opposite in the beginning, so if the message is not alarming, but the group is initially very worried, then they would turn the signal and would turn the message around to make it more worrying. Yeah? So basically what you find is you can find very quick polarization in social networks with this simple process of spreading information that fits to your belief. And so in research following up on this, we wanted to ask the question together with Jens Prüssner, who's in the room. Well, what happens actually if we don't have just individuals, but if we have individuals who are stressed? Yeah? And he has nice methodologies to actually stress people reliably, so to really induce a strong cortisol response, strong stress response. So we wanted to see, well, what happens to belief updating under stress? Yeah? Would the social amplification get even worse for stressed individuals, or would it be less? Yeah? And this is something that we looked at, and what we actually found is that social amplification is probably lower among stressed individuals. So here you see the stressed group in red and the control group in blue, and you see their initial concern before reading the articles and after reading the articles. So this is when they updated their beliefs. And what you find is that the stressed individuals are initially somewhat more concerned. Yeah? So the level of stress is higher. So your level of felt concern is also higher. But then they update their beliefs to a much lesser degree in light of this new information compared to the to the control group. So the slope of the control group is much steeper than that in the stress group. So under stress, it seems that people update beliefs less, which I find interesting. And that is actually mediated. So this is very specific, probably for psychologists. This is actually mediated by their cortisol response. Yeah? So for the stress manipulation, you have a higher cortisol response. And the higher the cortisol response, the lower the change in concern actually is in response to new information. Yeah? So it's a perfect mediation here. We also wanted to see how this actually works out in other fields. So we looked at vaccination decisions, which are also or at attitudes towards vaccination. And here we actually found that social influence was not present anymore. Yeah? But each individual, depending on their own beliefs, they flipped the messages around immediately. Yeah? So if I give a vaccine positive message to an anti-vaxxer, they will just take the message and violate it completely and pass on something that has nothing to do with what I told him, but that is basically anti-vax. Yeah? And the same happens for the pro-vaxxers. If they get a message from an anti-vaxxer, they will also just completely turn it around. Yeah? So the kind of self-reinforcement of your own beliefs and spreading your own belief is extremely strong here. All right, and with that, I come to the last section of my talk, and these are strategic games. Yeah? So here, individual outcomes depend on the choices others make. And I want to give you a little bit of background on choice dilemmas in general. Yeah? So these choice dilemmas are, I think, interesting to study for strategic decisions. Yeah? And the dilemmas force us to decide between actions that yield temporarily or socially conflicting outcomes. Yeah? So for instance, we face temporal dilemma. Yeah? Do I drink a beer now? That may give me joy now. Or smoke a cigarette now? That may give me joy now. But it is at odds with the optimal solution in the long run. Yeah? So basically, the current pleasure is at odds with long-term health goals that you have. Yeah? You could consider that a temporal dilemma. We have social dilemmas. So that the individually preferred option is actually at odds with the socially optimal solution. Think about public transport. Yeah? It would be better for all of you if you could just go on it for free. Yeah? If you just free rode on public transport without paying, yeah? You would save a lot of money. And the institution would hopefully survive if everybody else pays for it. Yeah? So it's better for you individually to defect, to not pay for public transport. But the problem, of course, is if then everybody does it, then public transport will not exist eventually. Yeah? So repeatedly foregoing the optimal option is interpreted as a failure to display either individual self-control in temporal dilemmas or social cooperation in social dilemmas. So we see that in social dilemma, if people forego the individually optimal option, then we call this basically cooperation. And then the question that one of my grad students, Felix Geisbauer, is asking is, can humans learn optimal behavior in dynamic dilemmas if they don't know that they are in a dilemma? Yeah? So often in many economic studies on this, the dilemma is perfectly described to people. Yeah? And here it's basically, again, like a banded task, like I had before, where people need to learn the dilemma in the first place. And basically what we did is we had a temporal and a social dilemma. So in the temporal dilemma, basically you needed to forego the locally better option. You needed to forego that to harvest the globally optimal option in the longer run. Yeah? So in each trial, actually, there was a local an option that was locally better on that trial, but if you chose that often, then you fared worse in the long run. Yeah? So you needed, on each trial, you needed to decide against the more attractive option. Yeah? So like a temporal dilemma that you have. And in a social dilemma, we put people together, and basically their outcomes depended on what the others were doing, and the best group outcome could be achieved if all individuals were foregoing the locally optimal solution on that trial, but were choosing the inferior option. Yeah, then they would be better off in the long run. And in both conditions, we actually had groups of three play this game. And in the temporal condition, basically not the participants did not know this, but their payoffs only depended on their own choices and their choice history. And in the social condition, their choices depended on what the others were doing. Yeah? And the kind of information that they got displayed was the same. So they saw what others were doing. So now, can they learn the temporal or the social dilemma? And what we found, and this came a little bit as a surprise to us, is that they can learn the temporal dilemma pretty well, but not the social one. And I'll only show you one condition here that we have. So here you see the position on the reward gradient. Basically, the darker blue it is, the better. Yeah? So this is kind of the optimal, and this is kind of the very suboptimal. Yeah? And what you see is here's the number of trials. It's 500 trials, so it's a long experiment. And in the temporal condition, people learn it over time, but they don't learn it in the social condition. And now you might argue, yeah, but well, in the social condition, actually there's some competition. Yeah. It might be that individuals try to optimize their individual outcome at the cost of the other two players, so that it's actually not a failure of learning, but that it's just strategic behavior. So we run a second experiment, and these are online group experiments that Felix programmed. This is quite cumbersome, actually, where we had a coordinative payoff function. So all the payoffs were shared by all individuals, actually, in both conditions. Yeah? So it was socialized, kind of. Yeah? Everybody earned their own money, but then it went to a pool and was then distributed equally among all players. Yeah? And also in that coordinative environment, we basically find the same patterns of result. Again, in the temporal condition, even though the incentives were shared now, they could learn to play the dilemma. And in the social condition, they failed to do so. This is, I think, interesting. And Felix can, of course, explain this much better than I do. So basically answering the question, can humans learn optimal behavior in dynamic environments or dilemmas if they do not know they are in a dilemma? They can learn the temporal dilemma, but fail to exploit social information in the social dilemma in disguise. Yeah? And this, I think, is interesting. So next question we are asking in strategic games is, how do actually individual biases, so the biases that we as individuals have and may bring to the group, how do they aggregate in choice dilemmas? Yeah? And here, think about climate change, which I think is interesting. So in the past experiments, we had a temporal and a social dilemma. Climate change is actually a public good dilemma that is both social and temporal. Yeah? So you have higher individual payoffs for not investing in climate change, yeah? But higher collective payoffs if people actually do, so if the group does. Yeah? However, the collective payoffs are actually delayed, whereas the individual benefits of not investing are immediate. And this could be an additional problem that makes facing climate change so hard, because we know from lots of individual research that people discount future rewards. So it's called the temporal discounting bias. So if I offer you a choice between you get 10 euros now or 11 euros tomorrow, of course, I mean, that would be a bombastic interest rate. You should always choose the 11 euros tomorrow. Many people choose the immediate reward over the delayed reward. Yeah. So the question is, do delayed rewards of the public good actually hurt cooperation in these public good dilemmas? So what we did here is we played a repeated public good game over some rounds. And the collective benefits of the public good were either immediate, that's the zero condition, were paid out after 7 days, yeah, and automatically they went to the bank account of the participants, so they didn't need to come again or anything, or were paid out after 90 days only, so 3 months later. Yeah? So these were the three delay conditions that we have had. And then we measured for each individual the kind of temporal discounting rate that this individual had. Yeah? So there are individuals who are very strong discounters, who really like to have the immediate benefit and don't care about the future much. And we have other people who basically have no discounting, yeah? Who are kind of would rather choose the higher later reward. Yeah? And now what we compare is, we first look at the individual level. So just at individual contributions, are individual contributions a function of rewards delay? and discounting? Yeah. And the answer is yes. Only for the 90 days condition, so that's the red one, we see this correlation. So we don't generally see that delaying the public good actually decreases cooperation, but we see that if the public good is delayed for 90 days, then we see it decreases cooperative choices for the strong discounters. So they are the ones who then defect, who opt out of the public good. And now I want to see, okay, these are substantial effects, but not so large on the individual levels. What now happens on the group level? Yeah, if we have several people in the group, and if we have a group who's on average more discounting than other groups, and we find that on the group level, these effects are actually much stronger. So you see the slope in the 90-day condition is much more extreme. The relation between group discounting and that is much higher. Yeah? So if we have several individuals in a group who discount the future, then actually a cooperation really breaks down. Yeah? So that could really undermine working on climate change, for instance. Of course, in this experiment, this was abstract with monetary incentives, but I still think it's a quite powerful example of how relatively small individual effects might then, on the group level, actually turn out to be much more extreme. So with that, I come to an end. From individual decisions to collective behavior, I'm sure you haven't understood everything I said. I'm sure it was too much and too fast and too different from what you usually do. But I hope that I could show you that for each of these four phenomena or paradigms for aggregation, consensus decision-making, social influence, and strategic games, it's actually interesting to start studying individual behavior and then see how it works out on the collective level. So what can we learn for the collective level from studying the individual, but also the reverse, what can we learn about the individual from studying the collective? And with that, I thank you very much for your attention, and I think I need a glass of water. We didn't assess memory in that study, but memory may actually be enhanced, especially for emotional stimuli. So probably that's not the explanation, if I get that stress research right. Yeah? There are some experts on stress in the room, so this is dangerous to say something, but I think actually that stress may improve some parts of memory and maybe decrease others. Yeah? So. So this is a very classic finding, and that's also true across species, which is called the mere exposure effect. So the more you're exposed to certain stimuli, the more you like them actually. And that even holds true for very abstract things such as letters or numbers. And that also holds true for other species. So for instance, if you play a tone of a certain frequency to an unhatched chick while it's still in the egg, it will like that tone afterwards more than the one that it has not heard before. Yeah. And of course, the biggest effects are between zero exposure and having been exposed once, but you also find continuous effects afterwards. So yes, I don't know how large the impact on elections will actually be, but I think with kind of letting some parties, for instance, dominate the debates that we have over proportionally. I think this is actually true in Germany, and this may also be true in other countries. That could be a problem. Yeah. Well, where aggregation doesn't help is if every individual basically either under or overestimates like the true value, right? Then aggregating doesn't help. So aggregating typically helps if you have some judgments that overestimate some property and other judgments that underestimate. So basically, if you have only noise and not bias, then aggregation will help. But if you have bias in individual decisions, then aggregation typically also doesn't hurt, but at least it also doesn't help. Where you find that it hurts, and I think this is the difference between these aggregation studies that I showed and the social influence data, is whether judgments are independent of one another. So if you have aggregation in a situation where one person, for instance, speaks up first, and especially if it's like a hierarchically high status person, then everybody will just repeat what that person says, and then you have, then actually you are probably worse than the individual judgments in the end. So for aggregation, it's important that you get independent judgments, that the errors are not correlated, and if these conditions are violated, then actually aggregation may hurt. And I think this is exactly the case in social influence. We are surrounded by groups of like-minded individuals, typically, and we influence each other and reinforce each other that this belief that we have is kind of normal in our social group, but then we don't talk to other social groups who have very different kinds of beliefs. Yeah? So every group believes, yeah, it's kind of all right that to believe that Earth is flat or so, because they are not in exchange with like rational people. Yeah? Yes. Yeah, that we studied rarely, actually. We have one study where we have a minority and a majority. And this is, again, a recognition heuristic study. Imagine you have three individuals in a group who have to decide, and this is also kind of a Drosophila task that we use, which of two German cities is larger, yeah? Weimar or Moers. Yeah? And then you have two people in the group who know both Weimar and Moers and believe actually Moers should be the larger city. But then you have the third individual, which is a minority and is ignorant. He says, but I don't even recognize Moers. Yeah? And in that case, actually, the majority of groups went with the ignorant minority individual. Yeah? With the example I gave, they would actually make a wrong decision because Weimar is actually smaller. But Moers doesn't have anything reportable about, so nobody knows about this poor city, yeah, which is actually pretty large, but it doesn't have any attraction, I think. So this is something where we studied minority influence. Of course, there's a lot of social psych literature on how minorities can influence groups. It's nothing we have looked at so far specifically.